I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Security will be tight for Sunday's Super Bowl game in Indianapolis, but the NFL is saying they're not taking any extra precautions to safeguard against possible protests from union members. We support their right to free speech, Jeffrey Miller of the NFL told the Indianapolis Star. Workers are protesting Indiana's new right-to-work law, which allows people to work and be represented by unions without having to pay union dues. Last night, thousands of union workers and their supporters marched to Lucas Oil Stadium right next to the festive Super Bowl Village to protest.
Who built this stadium?
We did!
Who built this stadium?
We did!
Sound from News 8 in Indianapolis outside the stadium, which was built by unionized labor. Union workers are threatening to protest again on Super Bowl Sunday. Chris Sikich is a reporter for the Indianapolis Star. Chris, first of all, this law is expected to dilute unions because it cuts their money supply. Is that why union members are so angry?
That's exactly why. They believe it's going to weaken unions. Any jobs that it brings to the state are going to be lower-paying jobs.
Well, you were at the protests yesterday, which started at the State House and then moved to Super Bowl Village. What was the mood?
It was loud and boisterous at the State House and outside on the front lawn. It was unlike anything I've ever seen in Indianapolis. There were a lot of them. They were loud. They were rambunctious. But once they started marching through the Super Bowl Village, the mood got a lot more quiet. They just walked through, they held their signs, and they went back to the State House.
Almost, what, out of respect for the Super Bowl?
You know, I asked the several workers why it was so quiet and subdued, and they said that they didn't want to start any trouble. They understood that football fans were there for football. The union workers wanted to make their point, not create a scene, and get out.
Well, the Super Bowl is expected to pull in as much as $400 million for Indianapolis, big time for the area's economy. And we know that some of the union members are torn over this. A Boilermaker named Pete Atoler was quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying, "I think it will hurt our cause. We want to build up Indiana and bring businesses here. And, you know, will a protest help or hurt?"
I talked to a lot of union members about this, and there was some, they were torn about this. Some thought that this was a great chance to get their point out. Others wondered if it could backfire. The union workers kept making the point that they had built the streets for the Super Bowl Village. They had built Lucas Oil Stadium, and they wanted to remain respectful of the Super Bowl. I asked them, too, if the Super Bowl was going to bring jobs, and, you know, maybe this wasn't an appropriate place to protest. And they said, well, any jobs are temporary in nature, whereas we're going to be here the rest of our lives.
Well, what do you think is going to happen on Sunday?
Every labor group I've talked to says there's not going to be an organized protest. So I don't expect to see anything large at this point. I do know that the AFL-CIO will be handing out leaflets during the Super Bowl Village to tell people about their cause.
Well, and the players have actually weighed in on the side of the protesters. The Players Union, which, of course, they just went through their own troubles, they have said they support the protesters.
They've released several statements saying that they stand shoulder to shoulder with Indiana workers.
Well, listeners are weighing in on our Facebook page. You can as well out there. Eileen Burke Price Olson writes, "I would think that the National Football League Players Association would find it interesting." And as we said, they have released statements of their support. But are they expected to do anything?
I haven't heard anything. You know, our Speaker of the House joked that he expects they'll show up and play the football game.
Well, if protesters do go, they won't be the only ones outside the Super Bowl. Tickets for the game start at $2,150. 900 private aircraft are scheduled to land in the area this week, which might, you know, make the protesters standing outside seem more sympathetic. But how is the general population responding to this? This is a Republican governor, Republican-led legislature. It's the first in the region to pass this right-to-work legislation. What are the average people on the street saying?
I've talked to people on both sides, and sometimes it just comes down to whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. The Republicans say it's going to bring jobs. The Democrats say it's going to hurt unions. You know, it's not going to – it's 10% of Indiana's workers are in unions, so it's not going to affect the majority of people directly. I hear things on both sides. I don't hear people really strongly clamoring for this. It's been an issue that's dominated the State House. I don't sense it's been an issue that everyday people are that invested in.
Chris Sikich of the Indianapolis Star, thanks so much.
Thank you.
who pays what in taxes? It's a question that came into sharp focus after Mitt Romney revealed he paid less than 14% on over $40 million in income over 2 years, pretty close to billionaire Warren Buffett's rate, which he's said was about 17%, compared to staff members in his office who pay an average of 36%. Buffett called on Congress to do something, and this week Democrats in the Senate introduced a version of what's being called the Buffett Rule, which would require people making more than $1 million a year to pay a minimum effective tax rate of 30%. But then groups like the Tax Foundation say Romney's rate, 14%, is actually higher than the rate of 97% of all taxpayers. Parsing who pays what in taxes can be as mysterious as the tax forms themselves because, as our next guest says, there's some cherry-picking going on. Let's bring in David K. Johnston for a primer. He won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on taxes. He's also a columnist for Reuters and distinguished professor of tax law at Syracuse University. He joins us from the studios of WXXI in Rochester, New York. David, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin.
And first, we know that there are apples and oranges here. Mitt Romney and Warren Buffett don't pay taxes on wages. They pay taxes on money made from investments. We're going to talk about that. But address this claim that most Americans also pay less than 14%. Newt Gingrich says he paid 31%. The tax brackets are, you know, for 25% and 28%. So address that first.
Well, what's going on is all these different parties are mixing and matching as suits their political interests. It is true for 1 year that almost half of Americans paid no federal income taxes because President Obama, as part of the stimulus package, put in tax provisions. And the Republicans wanted, of course, tax provisions. And we removed from the tax rolls a lot of people. We will soon be back to 35, 36, 38% of Americans who pay no income taxes. And who are those people? They're people who are legally defined as poor, and they are families with children who make less than about $40,000 a year. And why don't they pay taxes? Well, primarily because the Republicans added the $1,000 per child tax credit.
So you're saying that there are people making around $40,000 in families who are using tax credits to reduce their taxes, but then also the very poor people. I think it's people who make less than $15,000 get a credit because they pretty much it's assumed they don't make enough to pay taxes.
They get something called the Earned Income Tax Credit if they work. And they have to make over $10,000 a year from their job in order to get it. This was an idea by Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and Ronald Reagan called it the best welfare program ever because you had to work to get it. It's a negative income tax, and it's a way to address people who don't make enough, and instead of paying them to do nothing, you give them this negative income tax because they do work.
Okay. So millions of Americans don't make enough to pay taxes. Others with families, they have tax credits, so they reduce their taxes. But what about people in the different brackets? I'm looking at 25% tax bracket, which is making up to $139,000, or 33%, which is up to $379,000. Do those people, you know, pay, if they're in a 28 or 33% bracket, do they pay less than 14%?
No. And here's where we have to broaden out a little bit, Robin. Mm-hmm. We have federal income taxes, which are progressive. The more you make, the more you should pay. We can talk about how that works pretty well until you get into the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. And then we have federal payroll taxes. That's to finance Social Security and Medicare. And so if you're a single person and you're making around $80,000 a year, you're paying in the neighborhood of 18-19% of your income in federal income taxes, then you're paying payroll taxes on top of that, half of which come out of your paycheck and you see, but another half, which are your wages, are paid directly by your employer. And that's how you end up with people like Warren Buffett's secretary having a tax rate, then you add state taxes, that brings them to more than 30%.
So it sounds like you're saying that people who say that Americans pay, the majority of Americans pay this low tax rate, are just picking out the income tax portion of the tax and not counting the other payroll taxes that you pay. But you make the point that federal taxes altogether are just about a fifth of the taxes that Americans pay overall. Talk more about the rest of the taxes, because you say that those are carried, you know, disproportionately by people who are not wealthy.
The federal income tax is less than half of all the federal taxes, the revenues that we collect. And it's important to put it in that perspective. The purpose of an income tax, when it was originally introduced all around the world, including the United States, was to tax what were called surplus incomes. And up until World War II, only high-income people paid the federal income tax. Now it's been turned into this money machine, and we tax people at quite low incomes. If you're a single person and you're making $10,000, you're paying federal income taxes unless you apply for the earned income tax credit. And as you go up in earnings, your tax rate goes up, but it stops growing at under $400,000. So if you make $400,000 and someone else makes $40 million, you pay the same tax rate.
So there's that, but you also remind us that Americans pay taxes that aren't federal income taxes. There are state and local taxes, property taxes, car taxes in some states, gas tax. Do you agree with others who say that these taxes fall more heavily on the poor and those who aren't wealthy?
Well, that's what the data show, and I'll give you in every state except one, I think it's Vermont, the bottom fifth of families pay a larger share of their income in state and local taxes than the top 1%. And in a number of states, it's double. The extreme example is Alabama, where the top 1% pay less than 5% of their income in state and local taxes, and the poorest families, who make about $1,000 a month or less, they pay on average 11% of their income to state and local government. So other than federal income taxes and the state income taxes in many states, they're all regressive, meaning lower income people bear a heavier burden than high income people.
In fact, you did a study of the highest income taxpayers. I think these are 400 top payers. Their federal tax burden has been slashed. The actual share of income paid in taxes is 16.6%. You compare that to the vast majority of Americans, their total share of income going to federal taxes increased from 13.1% in 1961 to 22.5% in 2007.
Yes, and here I think is something even more telling. If you look at the top 400 taxpayers from 1961, which we know because of a statistical fluke, and now, the tax rate paid by the top 400 has fallen by 60%. For the bottom 90%, it fell too, but when you add the increases in payroll taxes, they're paying the same or higher rate. We have, over the last 50 years, but mostly in the years since Ronald Reagan was elected, significantly reduced the tax burden on the highest income Americans. And remember, we've only been talking about people who are taxpayers. There are lots of wealthy people who pay very, very little in tax, and in many cases, no tax.
But David, you say the real tax rate on the wealthy has been going down over the last 20 years, in part because their income is money earned from investments like dividends and capital gains. So let's continue our primer. What are capital gains?
Capital gain is when you buy something, a stock, a house, an apartment building, and you sell it later for more than you paid for it. And that difference, your profit, is called a capital gain because you had a gain in the value of your capital.
And dividends is money made off investments. You keep the investment, but let's say a stock spins off some interest, and that's your dividend?
Dividends represent earnings of your capital as you go along, just like interest from the bank.
Mm-hmm.
We used to pay very big dividends in America, 5, 6, 7% a year. Now we pay about 2. And that's one of the underlying problems we have today. But that's another show.
Well, stay with dividends. Dividends had been taxed at the same rate of wages. But we're reading a very colorful story about the history here. Eisenhower wanted to lower the rate on dividends in 1954, and then Speaker of the House John McCormick said that would be unjust to make a person with earned income, you know, wages, pay more in taxes than persons with unearned income from dividends, this money that spins off, let's say, stocks. But then you fast forward, President Bush reduced them in 2003 to 15%. Paul Krugman writes, this was on the coattails of what then looked like success in the war in Iraq. So it was only in 2003 that dividends dropped to this 15% that they're at now?
Yes, they had been at 20% for a while. But there's been a very profound change in America. Back in earlier times, earlier in the last century, conservatives and wealthy capitalists like Paul Mellon, when he was the Treasury Secretary, argued that capital should be more heavily taxed than labor. And now we've gotten to this argument that, oh, no, we shouldn't tax capital at all because that creates jobs. Well, it may create jobs. It doesn't necessarily do so. And I think it's a profoundly wrong argument, but it's a highly financed argument promoted by, guess what, people with lots of capital.
Well, and you and others have done studies showing that, in fact, and there may not be correlation, but in fact, jobs have increased when there were higher taxes on dividends and capital gains, and have not increased when there were lower taxes. But talk about capital gains. Again, this is when you sell something. We understand the only time in history they were taxed at the same rate as wages was in 1988, and this was under the tax reform law championed by Ronald Reagan. He then changed his mind about capital gains, and it was actually Clinton that lowered them to strike a deal for children's health care.
That's right. Under President Clinton, the capital gains rate was cut from 28% to 20%. And Clinton got back into two things, an expansion of the earned income tax credit for low-income workers, and he got a better health care for children. To those at the very top who live off their capital, it was a real boon. And by the way, only about 10,000 Americans out of more than 300 million of us collect a third of the capital gains. It's the most highly concentrated form of income. Almost all of it goes to high-income Americans. By lowering this rate 8 percentage points, Clinton gave the very wealthy a tax cut 60% bigger than the one Bush put in place in 2003. Bush lowered it 5% percentage points. Clinton lowered it 8 percentage points.
So Bush lowered it further. And this was at the same time that he lowered dividends, again, in 2003. And as we said, in the political atmosphere where he was seen as having a victory in the war in Iraq, and this passed through Congress. So David K. Johnston, that's sort of the history of how we got where we are with these low taxes on capital gains and dividends. What happens now? There's a move to, you know, raise taxes on, let's say, people making more than $1 million. We talked about this Buffett rule. What happens now?
Well, it depends on who we elect in the White House. If we were to elect Newt Gingrich, all capital would be untaxed. It would be tax-free. Capital gains and dividends would be tax-free. Romney would radically reduce taxes on capital. I think you have to look at what's the evidence of what this has produced. Over the last 10 years, we have seen the population growing at 5 times the rate of jobs. We've seen capital going offshore because with a push of a button, you can move unlimited amounts of money somewhere else. And corporations in America, non-bank corporations, are sitting right now on over $3 trillion, more than $10,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country, with no place to invest it. And that's because not that we have a shortage of capital, we have a shortage of good-paying jobs and enough wages in the jobs we do have.
You and others point out that while this debate as to whether or not lowering the taxes on capital gains and dividends has created jobs, as the backers say they would, there's definitely been less revenue.
Yes. In fact, if you adjust for inflation and population growth, the federal income tax now is bringing in a third less than it was in 2001, which was a recession year, and about 36% less than in the peak year of 2000. We are at the lowest level of taxes as a share of our economy since the end of the Truman administration. During the Reagan, Bush and Clinton years, the government was collecting between high 17, almost 18%, to a little over 20% of the economy. Now it's down to collecting less than 15. So if you want lower taxes, I'm sorry, Obama should be your hero. And I realize that's totally paradoxical, the idea that Obama should be your hero. But if you look at the numbers, it's under Obama that business has gotten huge tax breaks and favors of the kind that they didn't get from any of the previous four presidents who said they were going to cut your taxes and did, but nowhere near the way Obama has for big business.
That's David K. Johnston, columnist for Reuters, distinguished professor of tax law at Syracuse University. And I guess the other takeaway here, David, is if you've been looking around saying, wait a second, is everybody paying less than 14%? The answer is no.
Exactly right. And many people at the very top are paying a tiny fraction of 1% of their income in taxes.
David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Newt Gingrich was under the impression that Donald Trump was going to endorse him today in Las Vegas. In fact, we were all under that impression. But wait, the Associated Press now reports that the Donald is in fact going to endorse Mitt Romney. The Romney campaign has put out an advisory saying that they're going to have an event at the Trump Tower later today. We don't think he's going to be gambling there. So what does this all mean? Joining us on the line from Las Vegas, John Ralston, political columnist for the Las Vegas Sun, host of the statewide TV show Face to Face. John, what is going on with the Donald Trump endorsement?
Well, I think it's Trump doing what he always does, Robin, which is try to get attention, right? He is expert at that, and unfortunately, we in the media often accommodate him. The Gingrich story emanated from some local folks here who put that word out to a TV reporter here who unfortunately put it out, and then it spread as it always does in the world you and I live in now in the 24/7 media world on the internet, like wildfire, and suddenly everyone's saying he's going to endorse Gingrich, and then it became clear that he's endorsing Romney early this morning. And now, as you mentioned, Romney has scheduled an event at Trump Tower, and yes, he's not going there to gamble. Although, you could argue he's gambling by taking Trump's endorsement.
Well, some would say, what does this matter? Is it a good thing, bad thing? How do you think people in Nevada will respond to it?
Well, I think people in Nevada will respond pretty much how everybody else would, which is people already have very firm ideas of Donald Trump, right? And he has fairly high negatives everywhere you go. What's interesting, though, is what polling has shown about Trump is even though he is a rich guy, he has a very populist appeal within the Republican Party. And certainly you can say one thing that Mitt Romney is lacking is a populist appeal. So maybe he thinks Trump helps him with that segment of the Republican electorate, or you can be even more cynical about it, not that I ever would be, Robin, and think that this is just a way for Romney to take those controversial remarks about the poor that he made yesterday off the table and get all of us easily persuaded media folks to focus on Donald Trump.
Which we are, aren't we? So let's move back to those comments, because the thinking is that the only thing stopping Mitt Romney from winning big in Saturday's caucuses there is Romney, because this is a state with the highest unemployment foreclosure rates in the country. He made that "I'm not concerned about the poor" statement on CNN. He went on to say they have a social safety net, and if there were holes in it, I will fix it. But, you know, most politicians know not to put together the words "I'm not concerned about the poor." So how are those words reverberating there?
Well, I think it's too early to tell how they're reverberating here. Certainly, though, people will be affected by them, as you indicated, in the inartful way in which he constructed that. It's not the first time he said something along those lines, but Romney seems to just get himself in these kinds of jackpots all the time. Corporations are people. I like firing people. Even if he could justify saying the things that he does or, say, put it in context, you know it will not be put in context in a few months when the Obama campaign and the Democratic National Committee put up those words in 30-second ads, and that's what Republicans are concerned about.
Well, but right now he's concerned about getting the nomination, and, you know, he made those comments about foreclosures in which he said, just let them all, let the thing, you know, let it everything fail. And that didn't seem to hurt him in Florida, where he also had no plan as to how to reverse foreclosures except to just let the market hit bottom. But meanwhile, just to touch on some of the other candidates, Newt Gingrich is the only one who wants to give legal status to illegal immigrants who've lived in the U.S. for a long time. We have some Tea Party voters who aren't sold on him, though, and Tea Party favorite Sharon Angle says she'll endorse Ron Paul. So just in the minute we have, just a little bit on these other candidates.
Sharon who? Oh, yes, Sharon Angle. Yeah, she hasn't even showed her face in Nevada since she lost that Senate race to Harry Reid. And a lot of Republicans here have a lot of buyer's remorse over Sharon Angle because they think she was the only person possibly who could have lost to Harry Reid. That endorsement's going to do nothing for Santorum, who, unless something very strange happens, Robin, will finish a distant fourth here. Gingrich is in second place in a couple of polls that were released in the last 24 hours. I think it's a race between Gingrich and Ron Paul, who has fervent following here for second place here in Nevada on Saturday.
Although we should point out, Rick Santorum has the highest favorability rating. People like him. John Ralston, political columnist for the Las Vegas Sun, host of the statewide TV show Face to Face. John, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And we have a warning here. Our next story deals with drug abuse and a new way that people are making methamphetamine. You might remember early this week we touched down in Farm Valley, California, sometimes called the meth capital of the country. Farm workers there cooking up meth on isolated farm plots. They and meth users across the country are using a new do-it-yourself method called shake and bake. It's leading to explosions that are landing people in hospital burn units. And many of these patients are uninsured. They can't pay bills that run on average $130,000. And that's pushed some hospitals over the edge. At least seven are closing their burn units. Dr. Jeffrey Guy is the director of the Burn Center at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, a state that led the country in terms of meth lab seizures in 2010. So, Dr. Guy, start by telling us about this new method, shake and bake.
Well, this has been a huge game changer because prior to the one pot method, you had to have basically a chemistry lab in your home or your garage. They were easy to detect, they were expensive to set up, and they weren't mobile. Now with the one pot method, if you have a 2-liter soda bottle and basically some noxious household chemicals and some cold medicine, you can actually make drugs in a 2-liter bottle. It's easy to get. It's easy to conceal. You can keep everything in a backpack. And a lot of these people are very mobile. They do it in automobiles, or they do it in traffic or in a parking lot. So they're very difficult to detect in regards to law enforcement.
Well, and we understand that this method, the shake and bake method, uses less pseudoephedrine.
Pseudoephedrine, yes.
Yeah, this is the ingredient in cold pills that states have started to restrict because users are collecting this and using it to make the drug. They're trying to make it in drugstores so that methamphetamine users can't get easy access to it. So they're now using these bottles. Why are they more likely to explode?
Well, part of it is the method. You know, what they do is they put the chemicals in the bottle and they shake it. And in a period of about 40 minutes, you've got, you know, enough drug in the bottle in order to get high. And then they discard the bottle. And depending on how the bottle is shaked or whether it's even how rapidly they open up the cap, if there's oxygen that gets in that bottle, that will result in an explosion.
I mean, it sounds horrible. What are the injuries?
Burns to the hands, arms, chest, face. Some of the burns are minor, and many of the burns are life-threatening.
So what happens when they come into the hospital?
Well, they almost never disclose that they were doing something in the manufacturing of an illegal drug. They don't self-incriminate themselves. And so that creates potential hazards to EMS and hospital workers because these folks could be covered in dangerous chemicals. You need to get those dangerous chemicals off of them through a process of decontamination. You could, for instance, if you had a child of yours in an emergency room with, say, a twisted ankle from soccer, and they brought one of these patients in, you would not want your child to be exposed to those noxious fumes and chemicals.
There's another step we understand that affects the health of the patient, the burn victim. If they don't tell you, they may have injuries that you can't quickly get to. You tell a story of a woman who said she was burned by a toaster?
We had a woman who said she was burned by a toaster. She presented to her community hospital with that story, and yet she had been exposed to the chemicals and methamphetamine. They had gotten into her eyes, and by the time she reached us at Vanderbilt, she had serious eye injuries and lost her vision because of that. We have now mandatory reporting laws in the state of Tennessee. So if we suspect, we don't have to have much evidence, but if we suspect somebody was making methamphetamine, we have a statutory obligation to report that to the state so the patient is disincentivized to be honest with EMS and hospital providers because we have an obligation to report, and that could result the patient in legal jeopardy.
The other factor, let's talk about the cost. $130,000 on average, 60% more than other burn patients. Why? Why is it so much more?
Well, part of it is the socioeconomic status of the patients. They're uninsured, and these patients have really horrific injuries. They may be homeless from this event. A lot of these patients, the majority of them, all of them, really have some sort of form of drug addiction, and there's nowhere for them to go after they leave the hospital. The cycle just continues over and over again.
Well, and we understand how unbelievably addictive it is. So these huge costs have caused burn units to shut down. Some of that, there were hospitals that were consolidating, but some just couldn't bear the cost. What's happening at Vanderbilt?
We're very healthy, I think, but it's something that we're mindful of on a daily basis. This is an epidemic on the national level. There may have been hospitals consolidating, but there are less burn beds available in the United States today than there were in September in 2001.
Because of this?
Well, I would say it's a contributing factor by all means, large amounts of uncompensated care.
Is it possible that this is true? We've heard about 2 out of 3 of your patients are methamphetamine users.
Depending on the day of the week and the month of the year, that's about accurate. And it's not just adults.
How young is it?
Well, we've had infants and children who have had chemical burns because they have been exposed to the chemicals. They weren't necessarily in a lab explosion, but they may have walked through an area where some of the chemicals were laying on the floor.
Okay, so those are the labs, and now we have this new shake and bake in a bottle method. By the way, I'm sure there are going to be people irritated that we explained it, but you know, as we said, you know, drugstores are trying to clamp down on certain cold medications so that you can't get access to this. But what would you like to see, Dr. Guy? You may patch people up and they go right back out. So what would you like to see here?
This, in my opinion, is a physical manifestation of a psychiatric or an addiction problem. We have had patients that on discharge, a fellow who actually his heart stopped once. It was his second time. He was in the Memphis burn unit for a period of time. He was in the Vanderbilt burn unit for a second period of time, is trying to get cold medicines out of us. We had a patient who was featured on National Geographic who on screen was telling people just the nightmare that he had lived through his methamphetamine burn, and he was busted in a lab about a week after he was discharged from the hospital. The addiction to these drugs is phenomenal. And without addressing that addiction, it's just going to, the cycle is going to continue to recur. The other thing, as you pointed out, was drug stores or pharmacy chains are trying to make this less available. I don't know that I actually would agree with that. I mean, there are, you can walk into pharmacies, and I've done it myself, where you've got the buying clubs going on. People are coming in and you know, these large clubs of people buying the precursors to make methamphetamine. And you look, and right there next to the pharmacy where the pseudoephedrine is kept are 1 liter bottles of Gatorade. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you can go in and you can buy your precursors of methamphetamine and buy your container to make it at one stop and not have to be bothered by walking through the store.
So you're saying, I mean, here, you know, where we are in the Boston area, there's most drugstores, you have to sign your name to buy certain things. But you're saying that there are people who have sort of organized clubs to help buy the material to make it, and then the bottle that they need is right there.
If you get six or seven of your closest friends and you go to pharmacy A, you get to go to that well six or seven times, and then you go to pharmacy B. So you can see that these efforts to try to limit access to pseudoephedrine aren't really very effective.
Dr. Jeffrey Guy, chief of the Division of Burn Surgery at Vanderbilt University, on how the methamphetamine epidemic is landing people in his unit with burns. Dr. Guy, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
Take it, Gandalf. Take it.
No, sir, no.
You must take it.
You cannot offer me this ring.
I'm giving it to you.
Don't tempt me, Frodo. I dare not take it. Not even to keep it safe.
That's Elijah Wood as Frodo the Hobbit and Ian McKellen as Gandalf the Wizard in Peter Jackson's film adaptation of J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Shortly before he died in 1973, Tolkien sold the movie rights to his trilogy for £10,000. That's about $24,000 at the time and a small percentage of future revenues. The big screen versions raked in nearly $3 billion at the box office, but Tolkien's heirs had to take the studio, New Line Cinema, to court to get their share. An undisclosed settlement ended the matter in 2009, but family turmoil over the mere making of the films continues today. Despite that, the Lord of the Rings franchise actually inspired one young Tolkien to make films.
It's a passion. It's the only thing I feel I'm truly good at.
Nicholas Tolkien is the 21-year-old great-grandson of the famous author. His latest film premieres this weekend at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, and Karen Pelland of KDB Radio in Santa Barbara has his story.
When the film The Fellowship of the Ring first hit theaters in 2001, Nicholas Tolkien was 11 years old, and he imagined the film would earn him some serious street cred. But as he recalls, with a lingering sense of shock, that didn't happen.
People started teasing me at school about it. They used to call me Hobbit, and they used to, I mean, they were very upset about it because it was this giant thing that I guess I had and they didn't, and it was very threatening. But I guess on a more personal level, I've not seen my granddad in 12, 13 years. And the reason for that is my granddad fell out with my dad because my granddad, Christopher, didn't want the films to actually even get made. And he thought...
Your granddad, Christopher, was the son of J.R.R. Tolkien, the author.
My dad publicly fought him about it and was really for the films, just as I was.
Do you know why he didn't want the films to get made?
Well, he always said that they were better novels than films and, you know, almost were sacred and should never have been made into films. And he didn't really think that they were a good representation of the novels. And, you know, I respect that. That's his point of view. But I always thought it was ironic because, in a funny way, more people read the books after seeing the films. And to just, you know, use problems with my dad as a reason never to see me is definitely very hurtful. But, you know, to me, I'm not losing any sleep over it. I don't even really remember what he looks like, to be honest. And it's strange to have somebody who was in your life for the first 9, 10 years and then just disappeared over something that could have been great for everybody and could have been something we were all proud of. But I loved them. I mean, I'm for my generation to be able to see a story like that done so well by Peter Jackson, I absolutely loved it.
Did you read the books before you saw the movies?
I did read the books. My dad read...
Required reading in your house?
My dad read them to me as a kid, you know, and it was always... It was something I always felt good about until I went to school and was really teased about it for a long time. And it kind of associated a lot of negativity with it.
But Nicholas didn't let the teasing or the family feud interfere with his dream of becoming a filmmaker. He started writing screenplays at 13, and after graduating high school in England at 16, he chose not to follow the Tolkien tradition of attending Oxford University.
I moved out to Los Angeles by myself at 17 on this unbelievably misguided adventure into Hollywood. And I spent 2 months, you know, going to meetings and, you know, being told that I was going to be the next greatest thing. And then the door got slammed in my face, unfortunately. And it made me completely terrified of making this crazy jump across the Atlantic to this weird new world. But at the same time, it made me think that, you know, anything's possible. And if at 17 I can get a meeting with these people, then, you know.
I was going to say, just getting a meeting.
Sure.
I mean, you know that your name is getting you somewhere, but then it's up to you to deliver.
Yeah, well, my dad's an author, and he was a criminal barrister for 20 years. And then in 2002, he started writing novels. And, you know, his first two books were turned down by, you know, a lot of people. And I said, you know, it's not going to get me everywhere. It might get me in the door, but it's not going to get me what I really want, which is to be a filmmaker.
So Nicholas Tolkien took his bruised ego 90 miles up the California coast to Santa Barbara and licked his wounds.
It was an escape from Los Angeles and from this dangerous city that represented, I guess, my greatest fear of failure. And I thought, you know, I've got to try and create something outside of Hollywood because I have the money to do it and I have the scripts to do it. And it's just a question of finding the right people. And I honestly believe that the future of Hollywood isn't in Hollywood.
Once he settled here in the decidedly un-Hollywood postcard city humbly known as the American Riviera, Nicholas did find some local actors and crew and went to work on his first film, Anna Kappa. But for his second and current film, Masquerade, he says despite having family money at his disposal, he learned that less is more.
Masquerade was inspired by the fact that Anna Kappa cost $100,000 to make and it hasn't really seen the light of day. And I said, well, let's take the French New Wave inspiration of cinema, which is improvisation and very cheap budgets and guerrilla filmmaking, and let's tell a story that can be told for a lot less money. And what inspired me was what happened with Charlie Sheen and him getting fired from his own show. And that created the premise of Masquerade, which was this former child actor who'd grown up, who was in love with the idea of the stardom that he's lost. And he goes out to seek it on this reality show and then gets fired and replaced on it. And
replaced on a reality show where he's playing himself.
Yeah, replaced on his own reality show.
If we just take the ratings, right? We say, you know what, audience? We hear you, audience, that you don't like Charlie Best. And so we're going to replace Charlie Best with someone new, a better actor.
How?
It can be done. I will cast it and I will bring someone else in and we will see how Charlie Best's behavior is offensive and brings the ratings down as part of the show because it's a reality show. And that warrants another actor coming on. And I can do it, Simon. I can find someone else. Give me a weekend.
Masquerade cost only $15,000 to make. And with the Lord of the Rings trilogy costing $285 million, Nicholas Tolkien is clearly no Peter Jackson. He hasn't been to film school, is entirely self-taught, and firmly believes that any aspiring filmmaker with a strong story and characters can and should learn on the job.
You can save so much money just by focusing on the story and the characters. So to make something in a mockumentary style was so much easier than having to put together this elaborate production.
Like the Lord of the Rings.
Like the Lord of the Rings, you know. And I have to say, you know, if people weren't going to watch Masquerade, you know, they're not going to get hobbits, but they're going to get a lot of comedy, you know.
Despite his distaste for the cutthroat film industry down in Los Angeles, Nicholas Tolkien may one day find himself back there, with doors opening instead of shutting, and maybe even with a Lord of the Rings-esque budget. But for now, at 21, Hollywood can wait.
That's Karen Pelland of KDB Radio in Santa Barbara, California. Nicholas Tolkien's new film, Masquerade, premieres Sunday at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. For more, go to hearnow.org. As for Nicholas's great-grandfather, we thought you might enjoy this undated recording we found online of J.R.R. Tolkien reciting the ring verse from the pages of his famous book.
Three rings for the elven kings under the sky, seven for the dwarf lords in their halls of stone, nine for mortal men doomed to die, one for the dark lord on his dark throne in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie. One ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.